Hi, and welcome to the Cutaneous Connection, a podcast from the staff at Dermatology Times, aiming to provide you with the latest news in dermatology, exclusive interviews with leading experts, and a glimpse at what goes on behind the scenes of clinical trials, research, and innovation. In today's episode, Renata Block, a physician assistant from Chicago, Illinois, and host of Dermatology Times' Derm Dispatch video series, sits down with Dr. Zachary Rubin, a double board certified pediatrician specializing in allergy treatment and immunology. He's also the New York Times bestselling author of All About Allergies. In their conversation, Rubin and Block aim to bridge the specialties of allergy and dermatology. Rubin breaks down why the food elimination diets for atopic dermatitis management can do more harm than good, the immunology of the atopic march, the latest news in biologics and JAK inhibitors, as well as why hypoallergenic breeds are a myth your patients might need to stop believing.
Hello, my name is Renata Block, and I am the host for Derm Dispatch for Dermatology Times. Today, I am interviewing Dr. Zachary Rubin. You may be familiar with him because he has millions of followers on social media and is the New York Times bestselling author for his book, All About Allergies. We're going to be talking about how we can bridge specialties as well as debunking those myths, along with simplifying the science for our patients and how we can prevent the allergy march. And finally, we are going to be talking about future modalities in regards to treatment for our patients. Dr. Rubin, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
Well, I'm excited for you to be here too, because I have been following you on social media, and I know a lot of my colleagues have been as well. And your book is really hitting it on point. And I think as a provider, every provider in dermatology or not should be reading it, because I've learned so much, especially the history. I love that you covered the history of allergy and atopic dermatitis and all of that. I thought it was very, very enlightening.
Yeah, you know, especially I did touch a little bit on the history of dermatology as well. And I was surprised when I did some deep dive into it that dermatology is a relatively new field when you look at all the different specialties, especially because the idea of skin diseases, when you see a rash, people didn't want to touch it because they thought that was a sign of healing. Right. And that we know that's not always the case.
Right. And, you know, as far as like patients, the misinformation obviously out there, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you specifically brought something up that I think is critical as far as like the dermatology office. I can't tell you as a provider how many patients come into the office when they have a rash and they're like, what am I allergic to? What am I eating? And really, those are like the first sentences out of their mouth. And in your book, you help readers distinguish between a true allergy and atopic dermatitis, you know? So I guess for us as providers, when should we start pivoting from standardized patch testing for contact dermatitis to more systemic IgE testing that you discuss?
Right. So it's really important for folks to get a good history and understanding how this rash is developing, what are the potential triggers, and what do we have in front of us? Because there is a complete difference between an IgE-mediated reaction where you see urticaria and angioedema, you know, hives and swelling, versus atopic dermatitis, which is a much more complex inflammatory skin condition where, yes, you may find some triggers, but you don't always. And I go really into detail about the immunology behind allergy and how the testing can fall short, because you can have a lot of false positive tests if you don't have that clinical history matching up with the testing. So if you were to do a food panel, you end up potentially overdiagnosing food allergy. And we now know through meta-analysis of multiple clinical trials that dietary elimination alone will not treat atopic dermatitis in most cases, to the point where you're getting at least 50% of the skin improved compared to baseline.
Yeah, such important information. And, you know, the one thing that what I love that you did in the book was not only debunking those viral myths, which I still want to get to, but really simplifying the science for the patient to understand the whole pathophysiology of what is happening within their system. Because if they understand the why, then they could, I think, relate that back to the provider for us then to get a better history of what is happening. And that is something I teach my students all the time. The history is so incredibly important, and taking that time to get it is something maybe we don't have the time to do sometimes, because we're so busy in clinic. But I totally agree with you that that is the first step. So in your book, you are praised for making that evidence-based medicine digestible for the public. And immunology can be pretty complex. And I read the chapter and I thought, wow, this is just great. This is simplifies it for the person with this complex allergic concept, right? You are translating it to the audience without losing its clinical accuracy. So I appreciate that in the book. As far as the gut, lung, and skin axis and the impact of systemic allergy management on the skin's physical barrier, how do you explain that?
So, one of the things that I love talking about, which I discuss in the book, is that atopic march, which is you develop eczema as an infant or a toddler, and that causes a type of skewing of the immune response. We call it TH2, that leads to the generation of allergy antibodies. We call it immunoglobulin E or IgE for short. And that is a process that is not just going to stay local to the skin. Many people will develop that inflammation, that allergic inflammation throughout their body. It can be in their gut and lead to food allergy. It could be in their nasal cavity or sinuses and lead to allergic rhinitis or seasonal allergies or hay fever as different names for it. And it could end up in the lungs and lead to hypersensitive airways that we see as asthma. And so I try to really connect all these concepts together in a way that is not only easily understandable, but I don't want to oversimplify it because there's so many things that go on, and the nuance often gets lost in social media, online, or the fact that we just don't have enough time with our patients, like you just mentioned, is so important that when patients have a better understanding of how their bodies function and don't function properly, that they can then take that information and take better charge of their health to be able to ask the right questions, to be able to understand a little bit better what their doctors are trying to say. And so just even talking about the concepts that we just mentioned can really open people's eyes to why something's happening and what we could potentially do about it.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. And it empowers the patient, right? It empowers the patient to have the confidence to ask those questions, because I think a lot of times they may be intimidated to do so. So I appreciate that as a provider, because it's kind of one of those things you're walking out the door and you have your hand on the handle, and then they feel like, oh, I could trust that person, and I really want to open up. This helps empower them to do that. But talking about the viral myths, because you have a large presence on social media, what is the one, let's pick one, because I'm sure there's a lot of them, but what is the most, I would say, allergy hack or piece of misinformation that you see trending and that you felt it was the most important to correct in your book?
Oh my gosh, there's so many to talk about.
I
You
know.
asked me to do one.
Three.
I
Well,
think we're gonna,
top three.
well, no, it's totally fine to do one, but I want to keep it in context to how dermatology, is affected by this. And we've already kind of talked about this already, but I cannot stress it enough. The relationship between food and our skin, it's so important to really clarify it, because I see on social media where parents will say, "My child has eczema, and I got rid of milk, and all of a sudden their eczema disappeared." And saying that with confidence and clarity in a way that just really gets ahead of the nuance and the newer updated information that we now know food avoidance can potentially cause more harm in the long run for especially babies with eczema, because we know that earlier introduction and regular Exposure to allergenic foods like peanuts and cow's milk can help reduce the risk of developing food allergies that could potentially be life-threatening or even persistent and lifelong. And so I know we talked about it before, but that myth needs to start to go away. We need to move past it to look at atopic dermatitis as much more than just allergies, but more of this chronic inflammatory skin disease characterized by disrupted skin barrier function, abnormal microbial activity in terms of the skin microbiome. We often talk about the gut microbiome, but the skin microbiome is also there. The chemical exposures that people have potentially through fragrances and other exposures and substances. And so once we can unpack that and get past that myth, we can do a much better job treating atopic dermatitis. I mean, I see this in my clinic all the time where parents come in saying, "What is that one trigger for my child's eczema?" And that's the one thing that oftentimes dermatology and allergy interact together, is that we both do a good job with managing the skin disease and educating people about good skin care, and that's especially true for dermatologists. But when we talk about those triggers, that's where we need to spend a lot more time with the nuance of how it's not necessarily one issue, but it's a multitude of issues.
Right. And that could be overwhelming to patients, because it's could be a needle in a haystack, and maybe finding that trigger, can take some work and some detective work, if you will. So it can be also frustrating, I think, to a lot of patients where they just feel like they want to give up. But I think being that advocate for them, and presenting that message that you just beautifully put together would be a great starting point for those patients. As far as future treatments, can I know, when omalizumab came out and the representatives and the companies were coming to dermatology and we're like, ooh, this isn't in our wheelhouse. And a lot of times we would refer that to the allergist. But I feel like the newer generation molecules and biologics that are coming out can really be shared between specialties. And I say this because sometimes it could take a long time to get into an allergist or into see a dermatologist. And I feel like that's a huge challenge. What do you feel is on the horizon? What do you feel is the one thing that will change the landscape of how we treat our patients?
Right. So I think as we get more of an understanding of these diseases like atopic dermatitis, we will have more novel treatments in the future. I mean, you see an explosion of JAK inhibitors as an example of understanding how to block the different Janus kinases to decrease the inflammation in the skin. But also, looking into food allergy itself, we are starting to think of ways to kind of take what we already know and reapply it. So omalizumab is a food allergy treatment that's been FDA approved, but now there's a clinical trial that kind of intersects both allergy and dermatology, where there's a phase one clinical trial I talk about in the book, where they take patients that are adults with severe eczema already on dupilumab or Dupixent, and they're giving them another medication approved for multiple myeloma called linvoseltamab. And so what that does is you're knocking off the plasma cells and the class switching of B cells to produce IgE antibodies to slowly over time knock out all that allergy antibody production, that IgE production, to potentially put food allergies into remission, as an example. So this is ways of looking at the problem that we understand and trying to kind of reverse engineer it, which is extremely exciting to see this level of detail work and the efforts that are being put into these issues, because whether we like it or not, this is becoming more and more of a problem, and we also, because of that, have more funding and research going into it, so we're able to potentially fix a lot of these things from a disease modifying aspect that is just so exciting.
It is very exciting, and I want to bring up indolent systemic mastocytosis into this conversation because it's the prevalence is I think is like 2 to 4%, and that's the same as psoriasis. And I feel like the community and is really well aware of that disease, right? But not so much the indolent systemic mastocytosis, but I think that dynamic will change because of the therapy that is coming out, and we're going to be getting more people in who are suffering from this disease that we need to recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many different forms of mast cell disorders
Yeah.
that I talk about in my book, whether it's a problem with the bone marrow making too many of them, or they're hyper responsive to benign stimuli, causes people a lot of symptoms that could look like anaphylaxis, or they could be severe multisystemic problems that really impact people's ability to function. And this is a growing area of need where we need a lot more research and ability to identify these patients because when you do clinical trials, you have to be able to find the right population that fits the diagnostic criteria, and some of them a little bit harder to get that. And so I hope that with raising awareness will also lead to potentially more researchers getting into it, more funds being allocated towards developing better treatments and even just identifying, because it is a major need.
Yes, I agree. So one final question, because I know you're a dog lover. You have three German shepherds. I love my animals. Another problem that I have with patients, they're saying they want to purchase a hypoallergenic dog, which again, they don't exist. So how can we approach that question when patients come into the office?
Right. So when people say, "Oh, my dog is hypoallergenic," or "Can I get one?" We first have to understand what does that term mean? Less allergens, and sometimes people think of it as no allergens. And the problem is that when you actually look at the data and the scientific research into this issue, if you actually compare breed to breed, ones that are labeled hypoallergenic versus not, and you measure the amount of allergenic proteins that are produced, they're the same. And sometimes even breeds that are labeled hypoallergenic make more. Why? Because where are the allergens being produced? It's not the hair itself. It is the saliva, the skin cells that slough off called dander, and their urine. So every dog has those three things. Every dog makes differing amounts. So sometimes you can tolerate some dogs versus others, but you can't reliably predict that based off of the label hypoallergenic. And if we had the ability to test that, we'd be in a much better situation. But right now, we just don't have that ability. So we have to have a risk-based discussion to say, hey, I just need you to understand that it doesn't matter what breed you get. Some dogs are going to create more symptoms than others, and we just can't reliably predict which one's going to do that, unfortunately.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rubin. This was so informative, and I appreciate you sitting down with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. This was fun.
Like this podcast, have suggestions, or want to participate in future episodes? Contact our team at dtediter@mmhgroup.com. For more Dermatology Times content, from articles to videos and podcasts, visit www.dermatologytimes.com.